For those of you who don't know, my name is Marie Cornwell, and I'm a member of the Board of Trustees for the Sunstone Foundation. And Albert has asked me to conduct tonight. We're still arguing over who presides, but I'm conducting. I think what we'd like to do is to begin with a opening prayer by John Barraclough, and then the music, Jesus Gave Her Water, by a men's quartet. And then at that point, I will announce the rest of the program.
Our beloved Father in heaven, we're very grateful for the many blessings that are ours, and we are particularly grateful at this time for the opportunity that we have to be gathered together in this forum. We're especially thankful for the scholarship, research, and experience that have gone into tonight's program, and we pray for a special blessing to be with those who participate, that they will be able to deliver their messages as planned and prepared. We pray that thy Spirit will be with us this evening, that those things that are presented will be beneficial and meaningful for each one present. Again, we give thee thanks for all that we have and pray that thou will continue to watch over us and bless us, each one individually, with those things that only thou knowest we stand in need of at this time. And these blessings we pray for in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
He gave her water.
Jesus gave her water.
He gave her water.
Jesus
gave her water.
He gave her water.
He gave her water.
I wanna let His praises swell.
He gave her water.
Jesus
gave her water.
He gave her water.
He gave her water.
He gave woman water.
He gave her water.
Gave her
water.
He gave her water.
And it was not in the well.
Oh, there was a woman from Samaria came to the well to fetch some water. There she met a stranger. Who did a story tell? That a woman dropped her pitcher. She drinking was made richer by the water He gave her.
And it was not in the well.
Oh, Jesus
gave her water.
Jesus gave her water. Jesus gave her water. I wanna let His praises swell. Jesus gave that woman water. Gave her that loving, lasting water. Water.
And it was not in the well.
Well, on that woman He had pity. She ran back to the city, crying glory, hallelujah. Did His wonders tell? She left my Savior singing. She came back to Him bringing the town to see that water, Lord.
And it was not in the well.
Oh, Jesus,
He gave her water.
Jesus gave her water.
Jesus
gave her water. I want to let His praises swell. Jesus gave that woman water. Gave that loving, lasting water. Water.
And it was not in the well.
Well, now that woman left a shouting, cause there was no room for doubting that she had met her Savior. Who could her story tell? And every time she'd doubt Him, she'd start to think about Him. The man who gave her that water, Lord,
and it was not in the well.
What Jesus gave her water. Jesus
gave her water.
Jesus gave her water.
Water.
I want to let His praises swell. Oh, Jesus gave that woman water. Gave her that loving water.
Water,
water, water, water He gave her.
And it was not in the well.
Thank you. Let me describe just for a moment why this panel and why this focus. Most of you here today know that 1992 is the sesquicentennial celebration of the founding of the Relief Society organization. And what we want to look at is the effects on the church and on the women of the church of the decision by the General Relief Society presidency about how we might celebrate that. In August of 1991, a letter was sent out to all the Relief Society presidents and bishops and priesthood leaders, instructing local Relief Society leaders to plan and participate in a five-part celebration. The five parts of that celebration, beginning with the Celebrate Through Service project, also included, which we're going to talk about tonight, but also included a presentation focusing on the Relief Society history and life stories of the local sisters, an international satellite broadcast, the creation of a historical record at the local level, and a focus on literacy, encouraging all women to possess basic literacy skills so they could learn the gospel. Now, we could probably have a full session on why it was that the approval was only for basic literacy skills and not for furthering women's education. But we're not here to talk about that part of the sesquicentennial. Today, we want to focus on the impact of the instructions to local women's leaders that they should focus on service projects and reach out to the local community. Now, in order to do that, I've invited three panelists to give different perspectives on why these projects might be significant. We're going to begin with Jesse Embry, who is the Oral History Program Director at the Charles Redd Center for Western Studies at Brigham Young University. I have asked her to talk about the historical tradition of service in the Relief Society. After she speaks, I've asked Martha Bradley, who is an assistant professor of history at Brigham Young University, to talk about the types of projects that were implemented around the world and what women thought about those projects. Then I have our third panelist is Jane Edwards, who is the executive director of the YWCA in Salt Lake City. I have asked her to be here with us so we could get a feel from her of what the impact of these projects was specifically on the YWCA, but on other community projects and programs in Salt Lake City. After they are finished, I will give a few remarks, and then, as time permits, we'll have some questions from the audience. So I'll turn the time over now to Jesse Embry.
I just could listen to that music. When General Relief Society President Elaine Jack asked all the Relief Societies to develop a community project as part of their 150th year anniversary, her request may have come as a surprise to some people. In the 20-plus years that I've been attending Relief Society, the only service that I've done has been within my immediate ward. But as a historian, I recognize that these community services are not brand new. In fact, I could give many, many examples. I'm going to just focus on a few. At one of the very first Relief Society meetings, it was suggested the Relief Society was to relieve the suffering. And that Nauvoo Relief Society was probably mostly involved with members of the church. But once the people came to Utah, and even once they were established here, even before Relief Society was even officially started, there were some things started in 1854 called Indian Relief Societies. And Richard L. Jensen has written an article about these where women collected clothing and bedding and sent it down to the Indians in southern Utah. After the Walker War, Brigham Young thought, well, maybe if we convert the Indians, we won't have these kinds of war problems with them. and these Indians were apparently were not clothed well, so they needed to have clothing sent to them. Another Relief Society project started as a started as an in-house project and then expanded to a broader field. In 1876, Brigham Young asked Emmeline B. Wells to be in charge of a grain storage program. He had been trying to get the men to store wheat, and they had not been successful, and then they kept insisting the women wanted to buy fineries, and so therefore it was up to the women to now store the wheat. At first, the women guarded that wheat very jealously. They were saving it for the millennium. They were not going to share it with anyone. They weren't going to share it with greedy bishops who wanted it as a source of revenue or just a way to help the poor. But when there was a less chance of an immediate millennium, the sisters were more willing to share their wheat with the fellow saints, not only their fellow saints, but people throughout the world. For example, after the 1906 San Francisco earthquake and fire, there was a desperate need for help, and that notice came to the people in the Relief Society, and they sent, the General Relief Society sent a carload full of flour, clothing, and blankets. In addition, the notice went out from the General Board for all the Relief Societies to be involved in sharing their wheat. Emmeline B. Wells wrote an article for Exponent entitled Earthquake and Fire, which she published in May of 1906, and she explained that several other areas had sent flour, but they did not have the final reports in. And apparently those final reports never came in, as I read the General Board minutes when I was writing my thesis. But according to a Deseret News article, there were carloads that went from Fairview, Manti, Richfield, Provo, and American Fork. And from my research, I know that all of those had very active Relief Society grain storage programs, so very likely some of it was Relief Society grain. A year later, flour was sent to China during a famine. Calls had gone out because of this great famine, and the church sent some flour, and the Relief Society also decided to send some flour. By the time the Relief Society flour reached China, however, the famine was over. And so, therefore, the Chinese sold the flour and sent it to the governor of Utah. I think this is a really interesting kind of way to send money. The money went to the governor of Utah. He then forwarded the check for $5,800 to President Smith, who returned it to the Relief Society. And although the flour arrived too late to help relieve the suffering there, it showed the willingness of the women to share. Nearly all the wheat was sold during World War I to the U.S. federal government to help alleviate the severe grain shortage at the time. While it was billed as a community service, and the church received a great deal of public relations support as a result of it, it was actually an administrative nightmare. After intensive pressure, Presiding Bishop Charles W. Nibley had agreed to sell the wheat without consulting the General Relief Society President, Emmeline B. Wells. Wells eventually accepted the decision, but not until the whole presiding bishopric came and apologized to the General Relief Society Board. I would have liked to have been in that meeting. Following World War I, the presiding bishopric advised the Relief Society not to store wheat anymore. The money was to be put into a bank account and to be saved for a future time when it might be able to be put into grain again. And the women thought, though, that they could use the interest from this money to work on another project. They were particularly interested in the high infant mortality rate at the time. At first, the General Relief Society Board wanted all the interest to come into them, and then they would work out a program. But the individual Relief Societies revolted and said they wanted their own interest. I think this has some interesting implications. Therefore, the local Relief Societies were able to keep their own money, but they were encouraged to be involved in supporting a maternity care and a new baby program. Under this program, each ward would use its interest to help the mothers in the ward and to help with the stake organizations and the state government. Now, the Relief Society's concern at this time, right after World War I, were not just Utah concerns or Mormon concerns. The whole nation was very concerned about the high infant mortality rate. And in response, Congress passed a bill known as the Shepherd-Towner Act, which provided matching funds to assist the states who set up agencies. Amy Brown Lyman, who was on the Relief Society General Board, but who was also a member of the Utah State Legislature, introduced a bill which set up the agency within the state of Utah so that they could start receiving the money. And the Relief Society, the state of Utah, and the federal government worked very closely together. Cottonwood Hospital was set up as a maternity hospital. And in smaller areas, sometimes Relief Society halls were converted into places where babies could be born. And then even in the smallest towns, they would have a little layette or some kind of kit to help pregnant mothers. This The three organizations also cooperated with the Relief Society, using the nurse practitioners to help them, with the federal government being able to distribute their literature through the Relief Society. And when it looked like Shepherd Towner was not going to be passed again, Amy Brown Lyman got all the Relief Societies to try to get it to be passed. It's interesting that the senator from Utah, Senator King, was the one that filibustered and made it so that the bill was not only extended for two more years and then completely ended. Although the legislation was limited, eventually, it made a major effect on the number of babies that were dying at birth. The Relief Society was very active, involved in community service, particularly in the 1910s and 1920s. Many of these, such as the adoption service and the employment programs, were mainly for members of the church, but there were some that they did for non-members. In 1916 and 1917, they started setting up what they called milk depots. They said that children were not getting enough milk in their diet. So working with the Salt Lake Board of Health, the Relief Society established 5 milk depots in school buildings, and fresh milk was delivered twice a day. If you could pay for it, you could, and if you didn't, you were given it to free. Nurses and Relief Society volunteers handed out the milk. In addition, they gave classes for mothers, and they gave baby checkups. In 1921, the Relief Society published a report, and this will show you how the milk was being used. $76 worth of milk were given to the LDS families. $42 went to Family Service Society families, and $12 went to Catholic Women League families. The Relief Society also started a program where malnourished children were taken from the homes in the city and went on a two-week vacation out in the country. This was so successful in 1924 that at the General Relief Society Conference, one of the Relief Society women appealed for more farm families to be willing to let children come out to their places. The 1920s brought another project, which may seem very small, but also helped in community health. I work as a docent at the Church Museum, and if you go over there, you'll see in the Relief Society exhibit there's a bottle. It's full of flies. What the Relief Society women did is they put up fly paper, caught flies, put them in mason jars. Who knows why they put them in their mason jars? And then they buried their mason jars full of flies. Now, for those of us who are only occasionally troubled by a fly here or there, we probably don't understand the problems that flies were at the turn of the century. I recently went to the Jensen Historical Farm in Logan to a barbecue, and I think that they import the flies so that it'll look like a turn of the century farm. And I've been reading newspapers from throughout the West for another project I'm working on, and it's amazing the number of editorials and front-page newspaper articles about the need to control flies. Flies were even called the most deadly insect available. And so the Relief Society's program of swatting flies just fit into this national program to kill flies. Now, I could list countless other projects. During World War I and during the Depression, the Relief Society was very involved with the Red Cross and helping. And during World War II, they were especially helpful. This was kind of an interesting statement that happened. In January 1942, in the Relief Society magazine, they referred back to a statement that had been given out in 1940, which encouraged the members of the Relief Society to respond to the Red Cross as individuals, that the Relief Society should only do the Red Cross sewing if they had no welfare sewing to do. But in January 1942, with Pearl Harbor and the entrance of the United States into the war, this policy was reversed. Quote, now the United States is actually at war. The General Board recommends that the Red Cross sewing be done in the regular monthly work meeting in addition to the church welfare program. And in some oral histories that we've conducted at the Charles Red Center and also some conducted at the Church Historical Department, the women talk about how they did Red Cross work and how they brought made quilts. In North Logan, for example, a woman said that they had 3 or 4 quilts on frames at all times at these monthly meetings, and then they were boxed up and sent to help in the war effort. And after the war, the Relief Society sent clothing and soap to Europe. Now, Relief Society had great plans for their centennial. They sent out a letter probably about as early as this letter went out, considering the centennial, in 1941, and then ideas were all published. But World War II sort of threw a damper on all their great plans. But one of their plans that they had, which they carried out, which one we might call politically correct today, was that they were planting trees. And the women would plant trees, and then they could buy a little brass marker to mark on their tree that said that this was a centennial tree. I looked at the community service, and I really wanted to be able to find a point that said Relief Society was involved in community service to non-members up to this point, and then it stopped doing it. And I couldn't come to that. As I looked through the Relief Society magazines, I found a real mixed message. I found David O. McKay saying that women should render useful service through the Organized Relief Society. I found Bill Spafford saying that the most important community service that women can do is within her own home. And at the same time, the magazines also carried articles about the Red Cross and the need for community service. A 1970 article, last year the Relief Society magazine was published, said, "We meet the challenge by organizing groups of volunteers in Red Cross, the church, and other community agencies that collectively we meet the needs of the neglected, the troubled, the handicapped, and the ill. We need to make a sincere effort to serve and involve the entire community." This policy of involving the entire community has not been my experience in Relief Society. Most of them have been either individuals or ward, as I mentioned. For this anniversary, Sister Jack asked Relief Society to return to the concept of working together to do community service. Hopefully it will continue.
One of the historical characters that I most admired is a woman named Alice Merrill Horn. Alice Merrill Horn was one of the women who helped man the milk stations. And when she would go to work at the milk station, she would bring along her daughter. And she would bring a bag filled with crayons and pencils and papers, and she would set her little girl up at a table to draw her way through this experience. And during the day, Alice Merrill Horn would serve milk to the needy children. And on the way home from these trips to Vernal and to St. George and to places all over the state of Utah, as they drove home in their wagon, Alice Merrill Horn and her daughter would make up poetry. Alice Merrill Horn's vision of the function of Relief Society, and particularly the idea of charitable service, extended beyond the Mormon community of saints into the larger community. The community of men and women and children of different faiths, rich and poor, of all ethnic origins, and she taught this lesson to her daughter by bringing her along. The Relief Society was truly born in this spirit of charity. And now, 150 years later, the Relief Society leaders have encouraged us, those of us who are sisters, who are members of the Relief Society throughout the world, to build on the foundation that was created by those early sisters, to make our own contribution, whether it be with materials, with service projects, or with our time. To commemorate the 150th anniversary of the founding of the Relief Society in Nauvoo, Illinois, Relief Society General President Elaine Jack has asked sisters to celebrate the sesquicentennial through service, what she early on began calling celebrate through service. "We've given compassionate service regularly in past years," Elaine Jack said, "but now we reach out more than ever before to be a greater influence for good as we plan projects that will lead us to a new way of thinking and serving others in the community." Now, when I read you these quotations from the leaders of the Relief Society, I would like you to pay particular attention to the rhetoric, to the language. They chose these words so carefully in describing what they wanted to accomplish. The key to all of this, this Relief Society effort in modern times, the most important, I think, in our lifetime, certainly, this massive undertaking, is that it is service in the community, service on a local level in the community. According to the celebration guidelines, at the heart of each local celebration should be a project that involves all the sisters in what they describe as meaningful service, and which would allow them to develop and exercise charity, would help facilitate a unified sisterhood, and plan and carry out at least one or more local service projects that will bless the people that live in their neighborhoods. The great benefit that is going to come when everyone is in the unit is involved is in determining this new type of sisterhood. If they are all involved in the project to discuss, research, make decisions together, and then prayerfully consider what is good for the community, there will be a strong bonding that will occur. Carolee Hawkins, who is, in my estimation, the inspired co-chair of this event, this sesquicentennial activity, added, "We are hoping to develop an atmosphere of sisterhood and trust within our society and we thought that could best be achieved on the smallest, most intimate level. There is nothing in these guidelines that cannot be done on the smallest unit level of the church. She also emphasized the importance the board felt of teaching the sisters the process of community involvement, planning and organizational skills, a confirmation of the spirit. Process was certainly as important as product, Carolee would say. Let me tell you a little bit about how this all came about. When Carolee Hawkins had only been on the general board for 2 days, she was given this tremendously important assignment of organizing the service element of the sesquicentennial celebration. Carolee had been for a number of years the organizer of the BYU Women's Conference, and so she had organizational skills and enthusiasm that she brought to this assignment. But perhaps even more important was her personal vision. Interestingly enough, Carolee remembers that she was given almost no guidelines herself. She was offered very few specific plans or particular agendas or direction, but allowed to just run with her ideas. And she set to work immediately, and she said that she stayed up for a number of nights in a row after she first got this assignment and read everything she could get her hands on about the early women in the church and the way they had interpreted charity. And she was filled with their vision of what charitable work meant, which meant that it would be work in the community. Although Carolee was initially unfamiliar with what the other agencies of the church were doing, like the missionary program or public communications, she soon found that this was perfectly in keeping with the pulse of the church. Celebrate Through Service became, according to Carolee, the heart and soul of the entire sesquicentennial celebration year, and it maintained this prominence throughout the year. The general board itself took the lead, and they organized a number of projects using the members of the general board themselves and men and women who work in church headquarters, the wives of general authorities, as well as their own family members. And their projects included cleaning up highways. I thought before I came in here, wouldn't you love driving down the freeway and seeing a sign that said this stretch of road was cleaned by the General Board of the Relief Society, or better yet, this stretch of highway was cleaned by the wives of the general authorities. They also went on food drives to give food to the food bank. They collected eyeglasses. They worked in the school with no name, which is the school at the homeless shelter. They worked in the library and read to children. Carolee's own favorite program that the general board sponsored was a series of unwed mother seminars where they taught young women about budgeting, about decorating, about taking care of their babies, where they invited OBGYNs to come and give free examinations and advice. They called those teen seminars. The planners rightly predicted that some women in the church would catch the vision and that many would not. This was the most great departure for the church from long-established programs of in-house charity to one's own congregation. Another important departure was that direction and planning was to come from the bottom up. Isn't this extraordinary? Rather than the top down. And again, that is an important departure. And what happened is that many of the women in the church didn't know how to respond. They didn't know how to act to take the initiative on their own. Few projects throughout the church were the same. I think the most common project was groups of women making quilts. And isn't that a traditional activity for the Relief Society? But what they found is that when women were given a tad of opportunity, they ran with it. This is the first time, another important part of this project is that this is the first time that the Relief Society Board had an outpouring of response from the field. They had a response coming back. They have received to date more than 19,000 separate letters, descriptions of projects, testimonials, letters from the participants themselves, the women who have benefited, the agencies that have benefited from these projects. And they are starting to assemble them in scrapbooks. And as a whole, they will certainly catch a moment in time. The service projects were not just an event, according to Relief Society leaders. They consider it an important redirection or a new direction for the future. They all feel the importance of sustaining what they have done and making this the policy of the future. So this is a turning point. They were very careful when they wrote the guidelines. They suggested the process, the organizational methodology for organizing, for researching the needs in the communities, and they did not give very many strict guidelines as to what women in the church had to do, but the single requirement was that they had to reach out beyond the ward. Let me read you just a few things from the guidelines themselves. They said that they needed to research the needs in the community. They needed to determine the needs, the constraints, the abilities of the sisters in the ward. They needed to choose a project that would improve the local environment. They needed to plan the project so that sisters could interact and enjoy serving others. They needed to plan socializing events as separate from the projects themselves. I thought that was sort of interesting. The first response to the call for project proposals was an interesting one. And this is familiar, I'm sure, to many of you that read People magazine when you're at the dentist or whenever you read it. In Florida, the Relief Society, sisters of a particular stake, proposed raising money to raise a $1 million statue in commemoration of the young woman that died from AIDS that she had contracted from her dentist. Now, that's a terrific idea, but it didn't match the spirit of what Carolee and the other members of the general board had in mind for the Relief Society service projects. And they were dismayed. They didn't want wards to raise money and throw money at projects. They wanted the women to get out there and be involved in the projects. The second letter that came in made them feel a little bit better. The letter was from the Huntington Beach ward, and it described the project that the group of Relief Society sisters and eventually their husbands and their children all became involved in. One of the women in the Relief Society presidency had read an article that had been published in the newspaper about a young man who had been in a car accident in September. He was 24 years old, and he was paralyzed from the neck down, and he came from a very poor family, a family that could not afford, they had no insurance, they could not afford the physical therapy to get him back on his feet. The Huntington Beach ward is a very, very wealthy ward, and they could have very easily have passed around a hat and had enough money to pay for the physical therapy within hours. But they chose not to do that. What they chose instead to do was to make a personal commitment to that young man. And like I said before, the men and the children, they caught the fire of this along with the women. And the ward, through a six-month period, stayed with that young man from noon to 8 o'clock at night every single day of the week, Sundays included, and worked with his legs, exercised his hands and his arms. And Carolee, at the end of 6 months, was asked to come down to Huntington Beach and speak to their ward. And they showed her a videotape that they had made of this process. And as they watched that videotape as a group of saints, the tears rolled down all of their faces because they saw this young man, Paul, go from a position of total immobility to being able to walk across the room. And they knew that they had made that happen. Now, that plan, that project, certainly embodied the best elements of the dreams that these sisters had put together. Let me tell you a little bit more about some of the other projects. In Lima, Peru, the sisters went to an old folks' home, and they asked to visit women who had no relatives. And what they found at this home is that all of the women who had no relatives were sitting in the corners in incredibly shabby clothes, dressed in rags, with filth on their clothes and on their hands and on their faces and their hair. And they tended to them, and they brought them clothes. And they loved those women, and they read to them, and they rubbed their shoulders, and they rubbed their arthritic hands. It seems to me, in reviewing all of these different proposals that I've been able to find information about, these projects, that there were two approaches that wards would take. One of them, which is, it's something I think that we as Relief Society sisters love to do, which is like quilting or making things. The one approach is sort of antiseptic. It's where we can make something, where we can give a donation of money or some canned goods. And we can give it, and we can feel good about what we've done, but we never, ever have to dirty ourselves by actually confronting the poor person who's going to actually eat that canned food or sleep under that blanket. The second type of project, and I'm not condemning one or the other, I just think that I think it's interesting. There are two different types of project. The other kind of project is where these women actually went out into the field, where they got dirty, where they actually touched the people that they were helping. Those two approaches take a very different type of commitment. The organizers in one Southern California ward joined forces with Catholic Charities to open up and supply and man, I wish there was a word, woman, a food bank They womanned the food bank. They staffed. Thank you. In Logan, Utah, they opened up a no-cost health clinic. They found a location. They got all of the supplies and the equipment donated from IHC. They made teddy bears for all of the patients, and it is totally staffed by volunteers. In the Edgemont Ward, the Relief Society organized a service project for Alta View Hospital where they raised enough money to create a non-denominational chapel or meditation room dedicated to Nurse Carla Roth, who was killed in the siege at Alta View. In Samoa, this is kind of a fun project. The sisters decided that the clock in the town square needed repair. And so they all set to work chipping away the paint and sanding it down, and they painted it bright, sort of garish colors, and then they planted beautiful flowers around the base of the clock. And can you imagine what those flowers said? The flowers wrote out, "Charity never faileth." Just this morning, in I've been talking to some of you about what your wards did, and one of my friends said that in her Central City ward, they had two projects, and one was, in my opinion, a failure, and the other project was very, very successful. The first project was described to her by the bishop of the ward and his wife, who was the Relief Society president, who had come visiting teaching to my friend. And the bishop, of course, the man right off the bat, tells her that he didn't think they should be down there. They went to the homeless shelter. He didn't think they should be down there helping those deadbeats. And the Relief Society president said, "Oh, it wasn't so bad. We cleaned it up, and it wouldn't have been, but it wouldn't have been so dirty if the people themselves hadn't been so dirty." Now, I consider that project somewhat of a failure. But the other project, they attempted to involve everyone in the neighborhood in painting over the spray-painted graffiti that had changed the character of their neighborhood. And what that did was that it brought the community together, and it created a new sense of community and love that bridged ethnic and racial and gender differences. The Brussels Stake had some interesting projects. They went to an institution for the blind, and this is the way they describe what they did. They were giving them to eat. I don't know if that means they served the people to each other. Or no, they gave them food to eat. They fed them, and then they took them for walks, and they talked to them. They taught lessons of French to Turkish persons. I love that. They organized an organization for beaten women and unmarried mothers. In another ward in that same stake, they found that one of the small schools in their village had a number of children that had nothing to eat during the day when they went to school. And so what this Relief Society decided that they would do is they had assignments, and each day of the week, one of the Relief Society sisters would make a great big pot of soup, and she would take it over to the school and ladle it out to the children. In Marseille, the women went to the local hospital, and they were staging little Relief Society meetings on Sundays for the sisters, and that was fine and that was safe. But one day they found a little girl in the hospital who was dying of AIDS. Her parents had been trying to spend every waking hour with her, but they were exhausted, and the father's business was falling apart. And so they made this commitment that one of those sisters would be with that little girl day and night on this watch, along with the parents, spelling the parents. They were with her for a month and a half until Christmas Day, and they planned this big party to share with the mother and with the father and with the little girl. But the little girl died before they had the party. Let me read you a couple testimonials, and then I'll stop monopolizing the time. These letters that have come back from the Relief Society presidents all say pretty much the same thing. What they say is they are so excited that the whole idea of service has changed. They remember the old handbooks, for some reason, where they say, "Seek out the needy. Assist by correcting the morals and strengthening the virtues in the community. I see women on our committee investigating service who have never before had time to serve in the community, who shed tears as they tell about their experiences in finding needs of others. They say, 'I have been so busy with my own family and my job that I have forgotten how to serve.' We have a saying here, 'Help thy brother's boat across the moat, and lo, thine own has reached the other shore.' Thank you for adding this wonderful dimension back into Relief Society. And they go on and on and on in the same sort of language. So what does this all mean? I think it is significant that this is being done by women, that this is being really designed and implemented by the Relief Society, that it is such a dramatic departure from tradition, from precedent. It is very courageous, in my opinion. I think it shows the dormancy of this huge resource of power that is waiting to be mobilized, the power and the influence of women. I love a quote by Maureen Beecher where she describes the way women worked in the 19th century. She said that those women networked, and rather than creating ladders, they created lace. And I think this is exactly what is happening in this example. I was amused in reading the literature about these projects, about that the only visible part that men played, the public role that the brethren played in all of this, although the leaders of the Relief Society have told me again and again that they have been enormously supportive of all of this, but the public role that the men have played in this is telling the women how they ought to do their service, how they ought to feel about their service, and the value in terms of religion of what they are doing. While I have always admired the untiring devotion of women in all of the neighborhoods and wards that I have ever lived in, at serving the women around them in our wards, I have frequently been disturbed at the incestuous nature of our service. I have myself had a long-term and enduring personal commitment to service outside of our home and our church, and have tried to teach this to my children. I often drag my children out of the house to work in food lines or at fundraisers. And on one occasion, my 10-year-old daughter brought her cousin along with us, and I heard her whisper as Caitlin and I were carrying big, huge boxes down a staircase to Caitlin, "Well, are we going to be paid for this?" And she said, "Well, so why are we doing this?" And my daughter, Caitlin, just, you know, pulled her chin up in the air, and she said, "Oh, don't try and understand it. This is just what we do." I just love that. I love that because it felt to me that one of the ways that Caitlin was defining who we were as a family and who she was as an individual was that we are about service. And I love that. And I hope that that is the direction that we as a church are moving in, that we will start defining who we are as Mormons, as being a people of service, not self-congratulatory, but that we are truly reaching outwards. And so I salute this magnificent effort to set a new standard, a challenge boldly and courageously given. The celebrate through service projects of the sesquicentennial year of the Relief Society embody in the most concrete form the hopes and dreams of the Society's organizers. They connect women across the world in a true sisterhood that has spanned walls, that ignores differences, that has opened doors, that is expansive and more truly in line with Christ's example.
Thank you. That's been real interesting. And after listening to you, Jesse, about the flies, I think maybe we need to have the Relief Society back to the YWCA to work on our roaches. It's a wonderful story. In order to tell you about the impact of the Relief Society projects on the YWCA, I want to tell you a little bit about domestic violence, because their service was directly related to our battered women's shelter. In the YWCA foyer, the main lobby, we have a poster hanging that we received from the Coalition Against Domestic Violence. And it's a picture. The poster at the top says, "He beat her 150 times. She only got flowers once." And there's a picture of a coffin with a bouquet on the top. And then the script below says, "Every 15 seconds a woman is beaten, but for nearly 4,000 women each year, the abuse ends. They die." And I think that very dramatically states the impact and the incidence of domestic violence in this country. It is a widespread problem that cuts across all socioeconomic lines, all colors, all types of women, no matter what their walks of life are. The YWCA shelter was opened in 1976, and it was the first in the state of Utah, and the shelter movement only began in the early 1970s. There are now 7 full-fledged shelters in Utah, and when you add the safe houses across the state, there are 13 facilities that serve battered women. A little more about domestic violence in Utah. Approximately 57,000 males physically assault their intimate partners each year, and over 37,000 of these continue to abuse their female partners. Abuse, it escalates during pregnancy. Each year, over 144,000 children witness domestic assault between their family, between their parents. And in 50 to 60% of the cases of domestic violence, the children are also beaten. Approximately 65% of children growing up in abusive homes will enter into abusive adult relationships. And if this trend continues in Utah, the next generation of Utahns will subject 234,120 children to living in abusive families. And that's the thing that's particularly dramatic about domestic violence, is it is cyclical. Young children grow up seeing the abuse in their families. They learn that the norm in resolving conflict is to use physical violence, and that's what they perpetuate into their relationships. We serve at the YWCA approximately 1,600 women and children a year. They can come to the shelter any time of the day, and they can stay for up to 30 days without charge. Now, for those of you who have been to the YWCA, depending on when you've been there, if you've been there prior to the last 3 years, you may recall it to be a very drab building, in disrepair, done in cream tones, not a very pleasant sight. And in the last 3 years, we have worked very hard in securing donations to upgrade our facility, and it has made a beautiful transformation. We've repainted it, we've recarpeted it, we've restored a fireplace, we've put on wall covering, we've put on new light fixtures, a new switchboard area. It is just beautiful. And the one thing that our resources wouldn't stretch to do were the rooms in the battered women's shelter and the rooms in our transitional housing for homeless women. One particular problem in operating a battered women's shelter, because we can have up to 50 women and children at a time, and usually we are 2/3 to 100% full, and we have had as many as 69 women and children in our shelter. But one of the dilemmas is that physical violence is very closely allied to destruction of property. And when we have a full house, a mother with 9 children, pregnant with her 10, it is just impossible to control the activity and to protect the property. So into this dilemma came the wonderful gift of the Relief Society. And I can't impress upon you what a gift that has really been for the YWCA. On our 2 floors, we have a total of 40 rooms. And we had 47 Relief Society groups come into our facilities and totally redecorate the rooms. One Relief Society even took on our laundry room, which was totally drab, and fixed it up with beautiful flowered curtains and painted the walls and then sponged, painted over the basic color on the walls and put a beautiful trim, put rugs on the floors, put pictures on the walls. And it's just wonderful to go into this very, you know, routine laundry room and see this transformation. I'd like to talk a little bit about what One Relief Society did, because I think it really illustrates what you were talking about, Martha, about, you know, reaching out and bringing in the whole community into the project. And it also displays what Martha was talking about, both types, because the Relief Societies came in, they had contact with the women and children, and they had a very concrete project that they could do very creatively and put their whole selves into, because they just did it themselves. We said, here's the room, have at it. And they came in and just really made a remarkable change. The One Relief Society I want to talk about is the Mill Creek First Ward Relief Society. And what they did in terms of involving the whole community is they decided to have a rummage sale. And they involved over 200 people in their immediate community in putting on the rummage sale. They secured a $1,000 donation from Paul Ream of Ream Stores. And they also had the Deseret Industries donate beds that they could sell. And they ended up earning $6,000, which is quite a bit for a rummage sale, if any of you have tried to do that. They were organized by a steering group of five women. And when they came to the YWCA, they initially wanted to take on two rooms. And again, they came in with their own creativity, made quilts for the beds, curtains, wall covering, new light fixtures, pictures on the walls, rugs. Each Relief Society did something very individual, and we just let them do what they wanted to do. One thing they did with their $6,000 was they purchased $1,000 worth of underwear. And that is something that is very difficult because underwear typically does not come through in donations. And even if it does, you're a little bit, we're a little bit cautious about having women used underwear. But typically they come to the shelter and they often don't even have clothes. They just have the clothes on their backs. And so underwear is something that we always need. And they bought $1,000 worth of underwear. We also, on the Battered Women's Shelter, have two rooms that we've converted into a school room so that when the children are in the shelter, they don't have to interrupt their education. So elementary school-age children actually have a half day of school during the weekdays, and we have a full-time certified teacher from Salt Lake City School District come in and work with the children. Well, this particular Relief Society was really taken with the school room, and they wanted to expand their project into the school room. And what they did was they purchased a Polaroid camera with film so the children could use that in their lessons. And they contributed money for supplies. And they set up a listening station in the schoolroom. And right now they're trying to get a computer for the schoolroom. Another thing they did, as I mentioned, often women come in and they just have the clothes on their back. Another thing this Relief Society did was they collected career clothing for the women. So for women who still had to go to work or chose to go to work while they were in the shelter, they had a wardrobe. Women who needed to job hunt would have nice outfits to wear out into the work world. I recently met a woman who is a president of a corporation now that she founded, and she came to the YWCA to do a speech. And after her speech, she told me that she had spent one night in our shelter, and she had come and had escaped violence and didn't have anything with her. And she described how all the women had gathered around her the night before and had picked the blood out of her hair, had found an outfit for her, had found transportation. So the next morning she got up, she drove to the airport, she picked up her boss, spent the whole day with him, doing him around town, and took him back to the airport and just didn't miss a beat. And that's the kind of support that's there. Also, in talking with these women, I realized how touched they were by the problem of domestic violence. One woman had a neighbor who had been in an abusive relationship, and she was one of the fortunate ones who got out of the relationship and was able to create a new life for her. So she was really feeling that issue from the heart. Another thing that happened was one of the women who was on the steering committee had a daughter in another Relief Society, and that Relief Society took on another room. So it just sort of expanded and mushroomed into this incredible force in the community. And I have never been so impressed by a group of committed individuals. And it was just wonderful to see these groups of different women marching across the lobby with their pails and their paintbrushes and their Levi's and just ready to go to work. And they would stay and work the whole day. And they were really good understanding the schedules of the women and working around the children and working around the women. When I talk about the impact, it's really devastating for a woman to leave her own home, to leave a situation where there is chaos, and to go to some place that is foreign. And I can't tell you how important it is for them to come into an environment that looks nice, where all the quilts are handmade, and they match the curtains, and there's fresh paint on the wall. It's just a real nourishing message. And before, they were just coming into our drab rooms, and it is an incredible difference. We've actually had women go in and look in the room and just break down in tears because it's so beautiful. It's that kind of impact. And I've also talked about how it has just spread. Another way it has spread is that in our contact with the Relief Societies, different YWCA staff members were asked to go speak to Relief Society meetings. And that was a wonderful opportunity because I found the one time I went, the women to be so concerned about the issue and so wanting to help. And the women in the audience who had really been exposed to domestic violence. And you could tell they really wanted to serve and they really cared about supporting their sisters. Another thing that was real exciting to see was just this collective mobilization of women. And I'm not LDS myself. I grew up in this community, and I've always had a respect and an admiration for the strength of the LDS Church. But, boy, to see it in action was just really amazing. In fact, we've recently had something come up. We have a need in the shelter. And I was talking to the administrator of the program, and I said, call Barbara. She could come in and she could pull this together. She could do a beautiful job. So it was really a powerful witness to me to see that happen. Another way that it spreads out is I'm so proud now to take groups on tours of the YWCA rooms and to show them what the rooms look like, where before I was kind of embarrassed. Well, we won't go in the shelter, you know, the women are over there, and we don't want to disturb them. But now, come see this laundry room, and come see room 138. And people are just amazed. So it really is impressive to United Way, to our funders, to groups in the community who want to hear about domestic violence. It's really prideful for me to be able to say this is what the Relief Society did for us. They took on the renovation of the whole facility. I was also real impressed by the commitment of the women and how they really owned the project. I mean, they came in and they had it planned. And if we said, well, maybe you could take this room. No, we did this for room 138. You have three twin beds. We made these three quilts. We have these curtains. And they just had real pride of ownership in what they had decided to do. And it was incredibly effective, very, very effective. Another thing that happened is the women worked, they became attached to some of the women who were in the shelter and in the transitional housing. And one particular instance that I think was really moving was there was a young woman who was in the process of receiving instructions so she could be baptized in the LDS Church and since has been baptized. But a Relief Society redid her room and they became very fond of her and very attached to her. And one month she had a particular difficulty getting together her room and board fee. This is not in our shelter program, it's in another program. And the Relief Society got together and loaned her the money to pay her room and board for that month. And then she went out and spoke to them. So it just is something that really has been a nice exchange. And I just want to thank all of you. I think this has been real fascinating to hear the history and to see how it's transferred up to the present day and how it has impacted a very dramatic problem for women, the problem of domestic violence. And having a nice environment is really a powerful statement to how women can create peace and beauty in their lives. So I thank all of you.
I have a somewhat difficult task now to follow up on what these three have said, since I had no idea what was going to be said. I tried to get a number of people to do this job, but you're stuck with me. I want to talk about, for just a moment, and I don't want to take too much of your time, what this means for women in the church and how we can look at it as people who watch not only women but patriarchy. And in order to get you to think about this, I want you to do kind of a paradigm shift, particularly for those of you who are feminists in the audience. Because in the writings and the readings available on feminism and the role of patriarchy and the place of women, the focus is on the subordination and objectification of women in society. The emphasis is on gender hierarchy, that women are experienced as different and therefore as other. What I'd like you to think about, perhaps for a minute, is to shift that picture frame and examine women's lives not from the point of view of being the objective other, but as the subject, the acting being rather than the being that is acted upon. I don't think we have very good images of what that acting out might be. And as I think about what those images are, I'm drawn back to a scene in the recent movie Prince of Tides, where the woman who has a very abusive husband, in response to his complaints about the supper, goes in and basically makes him hash out of the dog food in the kitchen. And it's an image of women responding to gender hierarchy and to the masculine dominance with basically passive-aggressive behavior. It's the behavior of the powerless. I don't want to focus on that. I think we miss the point of what women do and what we are when the only way that we see them is acting out rather than being acted upon is passive-aggressive. What I would suggest is that women's acting frequently is as a response to the patriarchy occurs frequently, and the way that you see that occur is that all sorts of things occur that are not intended by the patriarchy. And I want you to think about that. What is it that women do who are supposed to be objectified and subjugated by men that are not intended by the patriarchy? As I look at the faces in this room see the women in this room and the identity they've created, the behavior that they carry out, I think a lot of that was not intended by the patriarchy. I mean, if I can get personal, certainly the patriarchy that we function under didn't intend to mold and shape women like Lavinia Fielding Anderson or Lynn Whiteside or Margaret Toscano or Lori Winder. Something went wrong somewhere. Which means that women do act out. And there's something that comes out of that process. And for that matter, I probably should say that something went wrong in the intentions for Marie Cornwall, too. But the point is that I want to bring us to is that Mormon women have a long tradition of this acting or acting out. And it's a tradition of responding to what I want to call PMS, which is another definition, which is the response of Mormon women to the patriarchal mindset. Now, I chose the P very specifically. I didn't use that other P word, partly because I wouldn't want to touch it with a 10-foot pole, but also because I think the patriarchal mindset is not unique to Mormonism. It is something that all women experience and that binds us across denominations and race and class. What is that tradition? Well, let's begin with the organization of the Relief Society. We have an organization of the Relief Society in which women took the initiative to write a constitution and bylaws. Now, never mind that Joseph's version of that Relief Society, the one that was instituted, changed the purpose, constitution, membership, and officers of that organization. What's important is that, despite that, under Emma's leadership, the new society was very soon engaged in a whole set of goals and objectives that was not intended or envisioned by Joseph. So there was a fairly early experience of Mormon women expanding who they were and responding to the patriarchy. By the late 19th century, we have women giving blessings identifying with a theology emphasizing gods and goddesses, practicing polygamy, and pushing for the rights of women to vote. It was the incongruities of these actions have not yet fully been described by historians or sociologists. How could polygamous wives be functioning to create new opportunities for women? These women, therefore, as Mormon women, were being acted upon and were also acting out. Now, Mormon women's legacy, I would suggest then, is one of finding breathing room in increasingly tight places. The patriarchy discouraged, for example, women giving blessings, and began to change the organization of the Relief Society itself. Mormon women responded by reaching back into history, attempting to hold on to these traditions, and what's even more interesting, when they returned to the present day, they returned with Mother in Heaven theologies and talk of ordination. Again, unintended by the patriarchy. On the more conservative scale, I want to talk about what the Relief Society is attempting to do today in the context of what has happened to the Relief Society over the last 40 years or so. The Relief Society organization has become increasingly controlled by ecclesiastical authority. We all know that. Now, it's not the Relief Society organization. But what's interesting is watching our current general presidency respond to that ecclesiastical stronghold, not only by what we've been talking about tonight, but also by their new fivefold mission. And let me point this out again, and I hope that, because I think this is significant. The fivefold mission of the Relief Society these days are build personal testimony, bless the individual woman, which is a focus on the diversity of women's experience, exercise charity, strengthen family, and achieve a unified sisterhood. Now, there is something significantly missing in that fivefold mission, because no one has said support the priesthood. It's not there. And I think that was an intentional change on the part of the General Relief Society presidency. The second thing is this effort on the service projects, and that's why I wanted to sort of invite us here and think about this, because in many ways it was a move that by a embattled General Relief Society presidency to empower women at the local level, I think. What are the outcomes? Well, you've heard some of those already, but let me just add to it some other ideas. One of them I want to talk about is simply autonomy. One can be empowered in any number of ways. One can be given ecclesiastical authority, for example, or resources, for another example, or one may simply be given the freedom to decide what needs to be done. I think that's an empowerment. These guidelines provided women at the local level as much freedom as possible to work within the tight places created by this strong ecclesiastical authority. Now, who created that freedom? Well, the Relief Society. Who missed the significance of that freedom? The brethren who approved the program. What a classic stroke of genius to actually encourage bottom-up change an organization, to say to local people, you can do something different, and furthermore, you can decide what that difference is. Second thing that I think is interesting that actually Jane has already mentioned is the race consciousness that has occurred. Martha mentioned it too. I think that the service that was provided was very much intended by the Relief Society presidency and the brethren who approved this program. But I wonder if they recognized the process that would occur in raising women's consciousness around women's issues. Issues like domestic violence, for example. coming to understand what the experience of women are and what the experience of women outside the Relief Society and many times within the Relief Society might be. AIDS awareness, problems with child care, etc. Another thing that's been mentioned, of course, is the legitimacy of outreach efforts. To actually legitimize moving out into the community, but not only outside the wards, but outside the home. We've moved beyond glass grapes, sequin tennis shoes, and Christmas decorations. And finally, one that I added as I was listening to Martha in her presentation, the creation of community, not only community within the local wards, but the sense of community I think we all feel when we realize that sisters in Samoa and in Brussels in Huntington Beach, California, Florida, wherever, in Peru, are all engaged in the same process of reaching out to their various communities. And I certainly hope that we have the opportunity to learn what those projects were. I think we only got just a peek through the door. What does this portend for the future? Well, the guidelines say, we hope that future Relief Study celebrations and homemaking events will include service projects. I hope so, too. I think it would be very unfortunate if that vision were dropped. Now, as I finish, let me say that, yes, I know that women are other. They're objectified by the masculinized power structure. But I also believe that that's only half the story, that we need to look at and see women acting and how they respond to in the patriarchy and to the context of their lives in order to really understand the gender relations in our communities. I just think we need to learn something about by watching how women act upon and how they deal with PMS in the modern church. Now, we have some time, and we have a mic up here, and I think we'd like to have you come up. I'd like to take some time for you to feel free to ask some questions of our panelists, engaging in some discussion of what we've talked about. Have any questions? I will not. The first question, I apologize to the men in the audience, but the first question has to be from a woman. Please. As soon as we have a question from a woman, we will call on a man.
Marie, I think we ought to celebrate the men who actually came to this session.
Yes. Thank you. Yes, please. Thank you for coming, but give us a moment, okay? Yes.
I don't
know if you can. We need you to come to the mic so we go on the tape, okay?
I realized there was a push from the general board for the service projects on a local level for the Relief Society. I was wondering if there was a similar one for the men and elders and priest quorum, et cetera.
Marty, you want to respond?
There wasn't an organized push that came down from priesthood leadership, but what I found in reviewing many of the letters and the reports of the projects was that it was irresistible, that the men could not resist joining in and participating. And the most wonderful projects, I think, were the ones where the whole ward took part. And frequently, Relief Societies would invite the young women to participate, and that was always very rewarding. But when their husbands and the men in the ward also came in, it was very rewarding.
Let me also respond to that. As part of the new consolidated meeting schedule, remember that, back in 1980, part of that emphasis was an effort to reduce the amount of meetings that people had to go to so they could become more involved with their communities. So, again, part of the importance of what has happened is that for 10 years, we had on the books that Latter-day Saints were supposed to be out in the community serving, And we still weren't doing it. And so this sesquicentennial project just gave some impetus to say, okay, now's the time to do it.
The story about Alice Merrill Home was so Horn was so inspirational because she was bringing this to life for her child. And I guess when you mentioned that we were supposed to be raising children in our families as a first effort to help the community, I wonder if I could challenge everybody who at least is in this room and anyone we are interfacing with, that our children are missing the vision of this in Zion. I'm sure of that because I'm in Mutual and have been for years, and we have projects for those kids to adopt sweet old people in nursing homes, and they can drive themselves when they're Laurels, but they just drop them. And I feel like we are in a situation here in Salt Lake, here in Utah, of cloying materialism. It's just embarrassing how our children are accepting it as their just due. And if we could be inspired through the sesquicentennial to convey to them their mission is to help others. It's really that, you know, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. Here in Salt Lake, we need to teach that aggressively. And I think it's probably a mother's part to do the best she can in that area because that's going to help our community. Do you want to comment on it?
Comments on what she said?
I think the key is in the guidelines to the sesquicentennial Celebrate Through Service projects, where they said that please try and have projects that are meaningful. I think that our young people, the projects that we organize to entertain them at Young Women's are not meaningful, and they can see through it. They know the difference. They know the difference between really being involved in a project that's going to make a difference and something that's just going to fill some time.
While many of the ward relief societies have obviously grown during this experience, and the individuals too, wouldn't it be interesting to learn what other growth occurred as a result of conflicts resulting from the tension between those who wish to focus on traditional making things, crafty little, as you said, antiseptic thing experiences, and those who really wanted to get in and get there involved in the community, and how these were resolved and what kinds of stuff happened, and kind of maybe even a few horror stories, and you know, no question, just that. No, I think that's a well taken comment. Part of the problem we had, and I'm sure the problem Martha had, is that when you base our discussions of what went on based on the reports of the local units, you only get it for those who had this wonderful experience. And it would be very interesting if we could, have the time and resources to do a broader sort of interview to find out what happened, what were some of the failures.
I can tell you a failure. And the only reason I can tell you this is because the person who told me this story just left the room. But in her ward, and I won't tell you what part of the universe this ward is in, they decided that they would make a number of baby quilts to give to babies that had AIDS. And this person is a person who loves dialogue. She loves the conversation part of all of this. And so her idea was that while they were quilting, they would come up with better ideas, more meaningful ideas. And what they did is they each took a turn describing what project they thought would really benefit the community. And one of the women was a woman who they all kind of acknowledge is a little bit nutty. But they love her, and they wanted to have her be a part of this. And her idea was that they would all write letters criticizing the presence of smut in literature in the local environment. And because she felt this so intensely, they no one dared stand up and say, well, no, this won't work, this isn't meaningful. And so they went along with her idea, and they came out of that quilting bee with that as their principal project. And so what happens is this sort of passive-aggressive behavior. No one writes any letters about smut, and they have no project. And, I mean, that's kind of a funny example of a failure, but those, you know, those sorts of things happened.
After 50 years of all these little things that you make in Relief Society, I'm so tired of it I could scream. And I made them all, and I don't need them, and I don't want them. I want to try to get rid of them. However, one of the most meaningful things that I have done this whole year was a very unfortunate divorce, and this woman had to move from a lovely home in our area to a small fix-up home. Our whole ward was there en masse. They took that front yard that was just loaded with weeds and great big overgrown trees. They took them all out. They cleaned up that yard front and back, painted. Some of them offered their carpentry help. They are making that home for her just as nice as possible. And it was one of the most exciting things because we had kids there. Young, old, men, women, everybody in that, and especially the kids, and they were working hard. And it was a project that it's really turning out very well. It's exciting.
Great.
This is some of my material for Saturday, but it's so pertinent. I'm going to be on the comedy thing, but this I'm trying it out on you here tonight. Because everybody, this is so good. Passive aggressiveness. I think of Claudia Bushman. How many remember good old Claudia, Boston years ago, saying before 1978, before the wonderful revelation, and that was right when my husband got his PhD from Harvard. I couldn't believe it. Heavenly Father, wow! It was that and the two together. It was beyond anything. But anyway, I remember before that, so you see the context a little bit. Claudia saying, because we were really bothered, obviously, by the black question, whatever you wanted to call it. I'm Peggy Sherlock, through my husband Richard's dealings, working at the Divinity School, through my working with Peace Corps, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, we were bothered by it. Claudia said, and she was great because she always said everything with an absolute straight face, do you remember? Like it was totally serious. And then you'd go, uh-huh. But this was an example. I said, Claudia, I'm so bothered by this black thing. How are we going to get the church to change their views on the priesthood, as much as I dared say it. You didn't know whether you could say it right out loud or whatever. And she was the wife of the stake president at the time. Richard Bushman was stake president, so that was a little fun. So I said, she said, very seriously, I think the way that we can have, this is passive aggression here, folks, I think the way that we can have it changed is for all the women to go out and to adopt black babies. And I went, oh, yeah. But she was absolutely, now I see that. Now I'd laugh my head off at that. No, we're talking about passive aggression. I said, wow, a little light. There was Claudia Bushman in front of my eyes again. She was wonderful. I went up to her once during choir practice. I was sitting next to her. Claudia, I said, you are the wife of the stake president. The church says we're supposed to be against the ERA. Claudia, what are your views, wife of the stake president? And she said, I think that we should respond to the light that is within us. And bowed her head fervently and said nothing more. Okay, and the other thing that I wanted to say, and this is really directly, I'm taking this out of my thing, but it's okay because it'll go on for longer than 15 minutes. Saturday, it's gone on for 15 minutes already, and I haven't even asked a question. But anyway, the other, which is very good, is Jill Mulvey-Durr here. I'm going to offend all the Chi Omegas. I remember going through an '07 whenever I was going for the University of Utah Rush. La, 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 be a Chi, Kappa, 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 all that stuff. And the big day, the very end, where everybody was thinking, am I going to be a Kappa? Am I going to be a Tri-Delta? Am I going to be a Chi Omega? Whatever. And this lady, who had happened to be a student teacher, quite a bit older, in a lovely pink dress, lovely pink hat, said, talked about how much Chi Omega, forgive me, Jill Mulvader, wherever you are, and the others, Chi Omega had meant to her through the years. And this reminded me when you were talking about, you know, materialism, false titles, you know, the very, very good comments that were made there. She said very religiously and fervently and sincerely, with perhaps a slight glimmer of tear in her eye, but maybe not. Maybe I was reading it where it wasn't there. And she said, and my greatest hope is that someday I can turn to my daughter. And at that very moment, here comes the daughter out in her little matching pink dress, ooh-la-loo, and her little pink bows in her hair, la-la-la, looking absolutely fastidious. She said, that someday, says the mother, daughter, that someday my daughter will turn to me and say, Mother, what I want most in the world is to be a Chi Omega. And my thoughts, I swear, I wanted to jump up and yell at the top of my lungs, well, isn't that funny? Someday what I'd like most for my daughter is to hear her say, Mother, I want to be President of the United States! Thank you.
Do we have any other comments from the audience? Oh, good. We'll have our token man now.
Not being in the Relief Societies, you can tell I'm totally ignorant of this program. Could you tell me what was the average extent of time involvement for the average Relief Society member? I mean, I know averages are somewhat meaningless, but I mean, could you, like, was this a few hours, a couple of days?
I think that varied.
Uh-huh. Well, that's what I said. I mean. But I mean,
I'm absolutely sure that varied.
Was this meant to be a thing that was done like in a morning?
It was meant to be an ongoing project, but that it had a beginning and an end.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay. Look. And I've done absolutely nothing in my Relief Society. I don't think they have one.
I don't think so. My question is. About membership in the Relief Society, do you think it's possible that the membership could be opened up to people who are not Mormons? If so, why, or if not, why?
Well, let me speak to the whole issue of membership. The Relief Society originally was an organization in which women, I mean, actually paid dues and became members. That changed in the 60s, about? Was it 71? Okay. And basically became the organization that all LDS women belong to. Now, in terms of membership, I mean, being a member of a Relief Society, it's certainly an organization that is open to anyone who's willing to sit there and listen, listen on a weekly basis. On that note,
cut that tape.
On that note, I think we should move to close this meeting. We have one more comment back there.